Discworld! It's Discworld! Podcast! Analysis! Yeah! Woo!
Good morning. Yes, it is a new day, a new year, technically. We are all a little older, a little wiser. Some of us are starting to grow hair in some really strange places, presumably. I am back on dry land in my usual recording position, sitting in the couch in the corner of my office. So no soothing sloshing or booming baritone this time around. Maybe I should record all the death quotes that I read out from the bathtub. Seems to give my voice that small caps effect that we're going for. But anyway, this is the follow-up to my top 10 or bottom 10, I guess, worst books that I read in 2022. And this is the positive version, the top 10 best books that I read in 2022. You've already heard the introduction to the previous episode, presumably, and if not, can work out what's going on from the title. And I don't have to give you the sign up to Patreon spiel because you're already here. So let's just get straight into things then. As I said on the bottom 10 countdown or count up, I'm still not really sure how that works. I do have a couple of honorable mentions. The first is a book I actually read twice this year, a book that came out in 2021 by Jeff Vandermeer called Hummingbird Salamander. If you're not that familiar with Jeff Vandermeer, you may be aware of him, or tangentially aware of him, as the author of the book Annihilation, which was adapted into a film a couple of years back, which is a decent film, but quite different to the books. But he is, along with China Miéville, sort of the figurehead of the New Weird movement, I think they call it, or I know they call it, which, as its name suggests, is very Lovecraftian inspired, or was to begin with. But it's sort of, yeah, a modern mix of science fiction, fantasy, and horror stuff. Miéville's works tend to lean more into fantasy, while Vandermeer leans more towards science fiction stuff, especially in some of his newer books, of which this is the newest. So I read it at the start of the year, just because it was new Jeff Vandermeer book and I wanted to read it. But I ended up going back to it, so the first time I listened to it as an audiobook, and the second time I got the physical book, and it took me about 3 months to read through it, like 20 pages at a time on my lunch breaks at work. But I went back to it because, yes, I'm doing the final edits on my vegetarianism and science fiction book that I'm running, and this is a book that, of course, came out just after I submitted my thesis. That is all about animal activism. This is definitely the science fiction book that has the most to do, the most in-depth engagement with animal activists and animal activism and things going on there. So is obviously of interest to me. Hence why I went back in to read it. I do think, though, that this is probably the weakest Jeff Vandermeer book, or maybe the one before, Dead Astronauts, which that one was sort of him going off the deep end. That is a very strange book. I think it's described or promoted as being kaleidoscopic, and I think that's quite an accurate description of that book, which is all about shape-shifting moss people traveling through parallel worlds to free space foxes from captivity or something. Whereas Hummingbird Salamander, which might be connected to Dead Astronauts, which itself was a sequel to Vandermeer's previous book, Born. Hummingbird Salamander is not explicitly a sequel to either of these books, but there is a whole thing. A salamander plays a pretty significant role in Dead Astronauts, so it seems sort of implicit, and that there is some signaling that perhaps Hummingbird Salamander takes place in the same universe, or one of the same universes as that previous book. But as to the book itself, I think the point I was trying to make is that it's a bit more straightforward. Although I think there's some cool sort of unreliable narrator, first-person narration things going on, at least through the first half of the book. The reason why this book hasn't actually ended up on my best-of list, even though I say it's like one of the weakest of Vandermeer's career, is that I think it's really strong for its like first two-thirds, especially the beginning. I think it's very good. When I went back to it, I was like, oh, this is great. And the end is very interesting. It is kind of a rehash of Margaret Atwood's Mad Atom trilogy, or the Oryx and Creek in particular. But that makes it interesting for me to engage with from a critical perspective, given that that book seems to be all anyone wants to talk about still. The problem with Hummingbird Salamander is, I was going to say it's back third, but I do like the ending. But there is a section in the middle where the plot really just grinds to a halt, and it does end up repeating itself. Like, in addition to being this, I haven't actually explained what the plot is. The plot is that there is the narrator, Jane, that's not her real name, but it's Jane, and she is gifted. I think there's just a lady in the street who gives her a taxidermied hummingbird, and the hummingbird has a note attached to it, and she goes on this whole, it's like a noir thing where she's tracking down the mystery of what is this hummingbird, where did it come from? And she gets involved in this, like, yeah, shady underground taxidermy things and bioterrorists and things like that. But it's very interesting for the first part, and then it grinds to a halt in the middle where it gets really into the noir sort of style, and, you know, we get a lot of double crosses and reveals of reveals and double crosses of double crosses, and it all gets a bit convoluted, especially when it, like, the middle section literally repeats itself. Like, the first part ends with her jumping off a balcony from an explosion, and then all this stuff happens, and then it ends with her jumping off a balcony from an explosion again. And I think, yeah, you could probably just cut that entire middle section and just run the first part into the more science fictional section at the end, and I think it would be a really strong book. But there are, like, 50 to 100 pages in the middle of this 350 page book that really drag, and I don't think add to the plot in any significant way. So that's why it hasn't actually made the list. My other honorable mention is also by Vandermeer, and it's one that I've read already, so that's why it's not on the list. It's also one I've mentioned already, and that is Born, the first book in this new sequence of Vandermeer's, which I had read before, read when it came out, and had always considered one of my favorite Vandermeer novels, if not my favorite. I don't think it is anymore, but it's certainly up there. But even knowing how good it was, like, after I read Dead Astronauts, I went back and after reading Hummingbird Salamander, I went back and I read Dead Astronauts and Born, and was really surprised both by how well Born had held up and how good it was, I think, still. But also just how much of it, like, I had forgotten completely. Like, it was almost an entirely different book to what I remembered. Like, it seemed like I had only really remembered the first part, the general setup, and the general gist of it. All the later sections of the book, and it really goes sort of, yeah, it doesn't lose itself the way Dead Astronauts does, but it goes places. It gets weird. But yeah, Born is really great. I wouldn't recommend starting with Hummingbird Salamander if you're not familiar with Jeff Vandermeer, but I'd say Born is maybe a good place to start, because it is self-contained, and it's just a really cool post-apocalyptic biopunk story. Like, yeah, my thing I've always had in my head about it, that was definitely confirmed by this reread, is that it's kind of a reverse Frankenstein. This is a story, rather than a scientist who creates a creature and then that creature is corrupted by the way he is treated. You know, people say he has a bad nature, but the implication is, well, he wasn't raised properly. This is a story about a creature that is raised properly, is treated well, is brought up in a caring environment, but has an inherent, I was going to say malevolent, but I don't think that's the right word, but I guess threatening nature to it, that has to be contended with. And, you know, I probably have a whole article or conference paper in me about this if I had the time to write it. But yeah, really great book, really interesting, highly recommend that. Would be very high up on this list if I hadn't already read it previously. But let's get into the actual top 10 itself, shall we? And I do want to warn that this top 10, not that I've done one of these before, but if I had, this one would be, I think, a little more homogenous than my usual spread of reading for the year would be. They'd probably still be packed full of science fiction and fantasy novels, but we are going to see a lot of the same authors recurring throughout this list, because I have been sort of more focused in my reading this year. And it's also the year that I really sort of got into reading more horror fiction. So yeah, I think this is a bit of a more homogenous and also perhaps pulpier list than I would usually expect. Yes, of course, this is the year that I really got into reading all the Stephen King books. So he is responsible for a few of these entries, beginning with number 10, which is his newest novel, Fairy Tale, which came out this year, or last year, I guess now, in 2022. I was going to say it's maybe the only newly released 2022 novel that I read this year. I'm going to keep saying this year. If I say this year, I mean 2022. But there were a couple of others. As I mentioned in my bottom 10 list, I did read the last Gwendy book, which was my least favorite book that I read this year. So King popping up all over the place in these lists. I also read the new Emily St. John Mandel novel. This is the follow-up to Station 11, which is another book that I read for the first time this year, and twice this year, actually. I don't think it's all that. That was one I actually had to read to teach in for a high school student. So despite my complaining about that last time, I think that was an interesting one to teach, though I don't think they were really approaching it in the way I would. But I read The Sea of Tranquility. I read The Sea of Tranquility twice, actually. I don't normally read books twice, but there's three books that I've read twice this year. I don't know if Sea of Tranquility is any good. I couldn't tell you. I think it thinks it's good. I don't know if it actually pulls it off. I started a novel called The Daughter of Dr. Moreau by Sylvia Marino Garcia. It's obviously a reimagining of H.G. Wells's Island of Dr. Moreau, which is one of my all-time favorite books of all time. But I haven't finished that one. I found it a bit dull. I got about halfway through it and I just wasn't that invested with it. So I will go back and finish that one, but I haven't so far. But yeah, there wasn't really that much that came out this year that I was actually interested in reading. I mean, there was, at some point I will have to read the new N.K. Jemisin novel, The World We Make, which was the sequel to, what's it called, The City We Made, which is one of the most disappointing books I've ever read. Like, it won all the awards and things. But I really like Jemisin's Broken Earth trilogy. And that book was the follow-up, and I pre-ordered it and I went into the bookshop like three times in the one day to see if they'd got it in yet. And then started reading it and was like, oh, I don't think this is very good. But I will just have to read that at some point so that I know if it's any good or not. And I also found out today, actually, that there is Jennifer Egan put out a sequel to A Visit from the Goon Squad, which I am tentatively curious about. That one's called Candy House, so I may have to check that out at some point. And who knows, it might wind up on one of these best or worst lists for 2023 if I end up doing this again. But anyway, back to the actual list itself. Stephen King, Fairy Tale, number 10. The best new book I have read this year. And I do genuinely think it's not right up there with King's absolute classic works, like a lot of his early 70s stuff and the ones he's known for and things, but I think it's definitely the best one he's done for a while. Now, a lot of people like the 1120, whatever it is, the one about going back in time to stop the JFK assassination. I do not like that book. Bit of a heads up if I ever actually do the Stephen King podcast. But so yeah, I think Fairy Tale is probably the best book he's done since he finished off the Dark Tower series, which is almost 20 years ago now. And that is maybe due to my taste, because this is King in like full fantasy mode again. And I did discover that this maybe isn't the most original plot. A lot of it direct details are lifted from Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes, which King does name check throughout the book. But I went and read that book after I finished Fairy Tale. I didn't particularly like it that much. I don't really like Bradbury's novels. I think he's a great short story writer, but I don't particularly care for his longer works, including Fahrenheit 451. But yeah, it is like Stephen King is more or less just rewriting Something Wicked This Way Comes. But even then, I think this book is really good, and it is kind of a testament to just King's skill as a writer. He's good at it. Which seems like a silly thing to say, but compared to someone like, you know, popular authors like Robert Pattinson, who I discussed in the Worst Books episode, like, King is aiming for some kind of literary quality and approach, and his writing, even in some of his worst books, is always propulsive. Like, it always grips you and drags you through most of his books, except for some of the worst ones, which is why I think he can get away with some of these 900 to 1,000 page books that he puts out, because they are just so, yeah, I guess propulsive is the word. I'm not sure how long Fairy Tale is, because again, I did this as an audiobook. I think I did almost all of these books I'm going to talk about as audiobooks, but like, it was halfway through the audiobook and none of the fantasy stuff had happened. Like, it was all just sort of this domestic drama story about this teenage boy, you know, becoming a caretaker for this old man, and it was just really engrossing. Like, that is kind of, in retrospect, the bit that has stuck with me the most. So like, the premise of this book is that the kid becomes a caretaker for this man. he dies, and then he leaves him his will, and it turns out he had access to a fairy tale world. And it's sort of a twist on the Orpheus story, or the Catabasis that we discuss with Eden, or that I discuss with Eden in the Soul Music episodes. There's a lot that could go into there, but as much as there is some really cool fantasy imagery and mystery and stuff in the second half, it's just the characterization and the writing during the first sections that really sold this book to me. And then, yeah, we have weird, dark fairy tale things going on in the second half to really drive it home. I do think the ending isn't as good as it could have been. I mean, Stephen King has a reputation for not being able to write an ending. I actually find that a bit of a weird criticism. I think most of his endings work really well. I think that reputation is mostly based on The Stand, where the literal hand of God comes out and zaps the bad guys. But even then, that is set up a little bit, like that is within the fiction of the book itself, as is the ending to Fairy Tale, which I won't discuss in detail here. It does tonally seem like, I don't know, a bit of a cop-out even. It does kind of seem like the Wayne's World thing, where they're like, oh, no one wants to end the book this way. Do you want to do the mega happy ending? And there's some unreliable narrator stuff that is set up in the early part of the book that I don't think pays off. I think he sort of loses that thread as he goes on, because, yeah, King famously does not write with an outline. He just sort of goes and sees where the story takes him, which does mean there are things that are just set up and dropped throughout his books. But they still, when it's a good book of his, are enjoyable to read and interesting in and of themselves while they're there. And I think that is true of Fairy Tale. I wasn't sure what to expect of a new King novel, especially after reading the Gwendy books, but was very pleasantly surprised and impressed by this book. So yeah, high recommend for Stephen King's Fairy Tale there, which I have just spent roughly 15 minutes talking about. This is why I can't do the 50 Stephen King book countdown thing that I was going to do, because it'd be 9 years long, almost as long as one of King's books himself. So let's move on then to number 9, our now third appearance by Mr. Jeff Vandermeer, because in addition to rereading the Bourne books, I also went back and read Vandermeer's first trilogy, his Ambergris trilogy, which is the first series he put out, and I hadn't read it before. I'd read all his later stuff. I hadn't read this one, so I went back and read that and absolutely loved it. I mean, it might be my favorite thing of his. I think his later trilogies, the Area X trilogy and the Bourne ones, if we're counting Hummingbird Salamander in there, all have like equal highs. But I think Ambergris is certainly his most consistent work. And Finch is the final novel in the trilogy. I mean, the first is a collection of short stories, but let's not get hung up on details here. Finch is the final novel. And this is, Finch is the name of the main character, who is a detective who is trying to solve a mystery where there appears to have been a double murder of a human and one of the mushroom people, the Greys, I think they're called, the Grey Caps, who inhabit this city of Ambergris, which is like this weird Lovecraftian whale mushroom city. And this is tying back into things he set up in the previous books. Again, like with Hummingbird Salamander, the noir detective stuff I found got a bit tiresome towards the end of the book. Like there was a point where I did sort of check out of this about 2/3 or 3/4 through, and was just like, okay, can we wrap things up a bit here? But it still makes this list, because I'm sure if I, you know, paid more attention to what was going on in that section, that it would be good. But also everything either side of that is just great. Like as I said, this is set in a world of mushroom people and whales and things, and just it's so cool. Like the Ambergris city is really great. And the ending to this book is awesome as well. I mean, this is set against the backdrop of, you know, an underground mushroom revolution that's going on. So yeah, just some really great imagery and just genuinely weird stuff. And where it goes in the ending itself when we get there, I think is really great. So yeah, that's why Finch is my 9th favorite book that I've read this year. My 8th favorite book that I've read this year is one I have mentioned recently on the Hogfather podcast. It is the novel The Tooth Fairy by Graham Joyce from 1996. Which won, I can't remember which award it was, but it was the British Fantasy Award for Horror Novel or something. Again, I think weird imagery might be the major thread throughout all these books that I'm going to be talking about, but this is a very strange and different book. Like, there is a tooth fairy, but the tooth fairy is also like a shape-shifting goblin succubus. and may or may not exist. Like, it's sort of this is a young child who befriends this tooth fairy monster or creature, and then is seduced by it. But it's like, it's very clearly a metaphor, an allegory for like a coming of age sort of thing, or it's engaging with those sort of themes. So, you know, how much of this is just a projection of his like sexual awakening or whatever. But while that sort of stuff is fairly trite, especially in horror fiction and things, it's just done really well here. I think this book's really well written, and it doesn't have much of a main plot. Like, there is a plot. There are things that happen. This is more a like thematic mood piece. It's just really good and really weird, but not weird in an off-putting kind of dense way, like some of Vandermeer's stuff where you really have to engage with it, or a long waffling on way like Stephen King. Like, it is quite concise and very readable, very direct, but just at the end of the day, a genuinely strange book. So yeah, I'm very interested to check out some more of Joyce's stuff. But despite this being an award-winning novel and things, it does seem like this was hard to track down, and his other stuff is even less available. So might have to actually order a physical book of his and read it with my eyes. But yeah, big recommend on Graham Joyce's The Tooth Fairy. Moving on now to number 7, which is Octavia Butler's Wild Seed from 1980. For people who are unfamiliar, Octavia Butler is the black female science fiction writer. And I don't say that disparagingly or dismissively. Like, that is the way she characterizes herself. Like, when she's talking about she was the first black woman to professionally write science fiction, and that she was the only one for a very long time. And she has the TV show Kindred that's just come out, is based on one of her books. That is one of her more mainstream literary novels, but it's also about time travel. So still very science fictional. And Butler is one of the absolute best science fiction writers ever. She seems to be gaining prominence, both critically and popularly. For a long time has been sort of an underground critical darling. I've had cause to go back and reread all of her works this year. Like, I'm currently finishing up adding a section about her to my book. And she is responsible for my favorite vampire novel, which was her final novel, which is called Fledgling. So yeah, Octavia Butler's great. For whatever reason, I had never read her first series of books, the Patinist series, which for a long time I didn't actually know existed, because everyone who critically talks about Butler just talks about mostly her Xenogenesis trilogy, and then her Parable books, and then maybe a bit of Kindred. So for a long time, I wasn't aware that she had this previous series. And I think, again, that is gaining more traction, more recognition now. But so I had cause to go back and actually read that this year, the Patinist novels, of which there are four or five, depending on who you ask, because of course one of them Butler completely disowned and refused to have republished. But we won't get into that now. What we will get into are Wild Seed, which I think was the third published books of the Patinist books, but is the earliest set. So the premise of the Patinist series is the Patinists are these telekinetic people. They're sort of like the next evolution of humanity that are all psychic, and then they link all their minds together in a pattern, and that is how they are able to come to power. And they are shown in what is the last chronological book, but I think that the first published book, but not the first written book, that they are eventually they are in charge of the earth, and they are pitted against these like werecat creatures, or they're not were because they don't change, but they're like hybrid cat human creatures called Clayarchs. But that part isn't relevant to this book, because this is the earliest set book and is about how the Patinists themselves are created, which turns out to be through a eugenic breeding program orchestrated by a body-stealing psychic vampire and his shape-shifting girlfriend. Because, of course, why wouldn't it be? I mean, a girlfriend is a loaded term there, because she is also his slave. And Butler's sexual politics are complex, to say the least. I mean, as in all of her books, literally every single one, this is a young woman who is subjugated by a much older male, but, you know, kind of ends up deciding that she's into it. That seems to be a theme throughout throughout Butler's work. And while I complained about that as it related to, what was it, Boulder's Love, the Gwyneth Jones book in my Worst Books of the Year podcast, for Butler, it definitely is more nuanced, more complex, more thematic, more explored in all her works, not just this one, but it is particularly essential to Wild Seed, which, yes, is really just touching on all these things, themes of obviously slavery and sexism and things like that, but also animal ethics. But at the end of the day, is also just a really cool story about cool is maybe not the right word, but a really, really interesting story about shape-shifting psychic vampires creating a race of superhuman telepaths. So, again, with some of the Vandermeer stuff, just weird, inventive science fiction, which is when I think at its best. So at number six, we're going back to fantasy. It turns out I've read more fantasy this year than science fiction stuff. But at number six, I have an absolute fantasy classic, which is The Neverending Story from 1979 by Michael Ende. And the words of Cameron Kunzelman from the Homestuck Made This World podcast bonusodes. This book whips. The Neverending Story is fucking great. I did read it because I'd been listening to that podcast, and also I think it's alluded to in King's Fairy Tale as well. But for whatever reason, I checked out The Neverending Story this year, which in any other year, like, this is never a book I would have thought to have read, but I'm extremely glad I did, because it's great and also really different from the movies and the cartoon series, which, you know, is what I presume most people primarily know it for. But the book itself is a lot darker and weirder, and again, just weird, cool imagery. This is the theme of the year, but there's so many just scenes in The Neverending Story, which is more or less a sequence of cool scenes. I think the one that they talk about in the Homestuck podcast, which is definitely the standout to me as well, is there is a, like, spirit of the desert and a spirit of the oasis that are, like, the same creature that can never meet each other, because one is death and one is life, and they're like these colossal creatures who are, like, hunting each other but can never meet. It's really awesome. But even some of the stuff in the movie, like the famous scenes of the giant turtle and the rock monsters and even the big fluffy luck dragon, that all look really campy and ridiculous in the films, just have this really awesome tone to them, and dark, weird ways that they function in the book. And also there's, like, some weird metafiction stuff going on with this book, along with the fact that it's the reader who's in the story who goes into the story and all of that. I did listen to this as an audiobook, but I'm aware that the actual physical book itself is written in, like, the different sections, whether depending on which world you're in. And now I realize, of course, the Stephen King allusion is the Dark Tower. But anyway, depending on which world you're in, there's, like, written in, some sections are written in green and some sections are written in red. And that actually does, like, tie into some of the stuff that's going on in the book. So I did check that out. Like, I had a look at a physical version after the fact and sort of, you know, understood how it functioned. But I didn't get that experience as I was going through. But still, just the story itself, I thought, was really great, really memorable, really transfixing. And yeah, high recommend to people who may not be aware even that The Neverending Story is a book, or once they are aware of it, sort of dismiss it as this childish, campy thing based on the 80s films. It's not. It's completely different, and it's really great. The sixth best book I've read this year, even. All right, getting into the top five. So at number five, we have the novel Wolves of the Keller from 2003 by Mr. Stephen King. This is the fifth, I want to say, Dark Tower book, and the first that he published after, like, I think it was almost a decade-long hiatus, where he then suddenly came back and published the last three books all in 2 years. And this is a bit of a controversial book in the series, as well as King's overall oeuvre, or so I'm led to believe. For me, it is, like, far and above one of his best books. I understand some of the resistance to it, in that the ending, the reveal of the ending, I don't want to say it's ridiculous, because it does actually, I think, fit in very neatly with the themes of the Dark Tower series as a whole, but is maybe not the most well-handled, well-orchestrated reveal as it could have been. And I think the reference to a certain boy wizard is particularly egregious. If you want to hear what that is, I do talk about this I put out one of the What You've Been Reading episodes on the main feed that has the section at the end where I get Alice to guess which of the, I think it's five or six ridiculous things that happen in the Dark Tower series aren't true. So one of the examples in there is the reveal at the end of this book. So if you're interested to find that out, you can go and listen to that, or you could just, you know, Google it. But that one sentence, and that is just missing a little bit, because it is core to the mystery and the point of the book and the series as a whole. But that one sentence for me does not undo the rest of everything that's great about the book, you know, from the 700 or so pages leading up to that. And the reveal itself kind of ties into the broader themes of the Dark Tower's overarching plot. The Wolves of the Keller itself is kind of a self-contained story. I mean, it's King's Seven Samurai story. This is about the gunslingers, as they are known, the hero protagonists, come to a town and they have to defend the town from a bunch of raiders. And it's less about that, although we do get some cool action stuff and some weird science fiction reveals at the end. But, you know, this is the mood piece of sitting in the village, and it's reflective character study thing. But also the other thing that's going on in parallel to that is they run into Father Callahan, the priest from Salem's Lot, King's second book, who Mightily Oates from Carpe Jugulum is heavily based on. This is the priest who goes to fight a vampire as a test of his faith, and in King's version gets completely owned, in that the vampire in Salem's Lot, whose name I cannot remember right now, but yeah, Father Callahan goes to confront him and is like, the power of Christ compels you and all that, and the vampire just laughs at him and then you know, drowns him in his own blood and forces him to drink it. And then Father Callahan's faith is completely shattered, and he's like, oh, there is evil is real, and I don't know how we could ever oppose it. And he is a broken man who just leaves. He just leaves the town. But he shows up again here, because it turns out after that, Father Callahan, he became a dimension-hopping vampire hunter and has been jumping around through the parallel worlds, kicking ass, not taking names, just kicking ass, which maybe undercuts the character study of him as a broken man in Salem's Lot, but fuck me, it's so cool. It's so fucking cool, you guys. Like, the vampire story in Wolves of the Keller is, yeah, really great. Sort of the book itself of the Seven Samurai thing is already really cool, and then it has one of the best vampire novels just stuck in the middle of it. There's also a lot of detail about this as Callahan's become the sort of, like, I Am Legend guy, scientifically breaking down and categorizing all the different vampires and things like that. So very interesting to me. But it's also just, like, fun, pulpy horror, vampire action stuff going on there. So maybe I'm not selling this book, but as a fantasy novel, I think this is really great and one of my favorite King novels overall. I do want to give a sort of additional honorable mention as well to the final Dark Tower novel, which came out a year later in 2004, which has nothing to do with any of this stuff. This is now the characters are jumping into the real world, and they're having to save Stephen King himself from a car crash or a hit and run. So there's a lot more to do with the metafiction and the overarching narrative. Again, this is a controversial entry in the series. For me, it really works. I think a lot of people, or I'm led to believe that a lot of people like the early, more Western fantasy Dark Tower books from the 80s and the early 90s, and then a lot of people were seemingly disappointed by the more metafictional turn of these final three novels. For me, I really like the final one. The middle one is clearly inferior to the other two, the Song of Susanna, but still has some interesting stuff in it. Yeah, for me, the final Dark Tower novel, and especially Wolves of the Keller, are among Stephen King's best books, and I think they're really great. And trudging on, we have back-to-back appearances, because at number four, I have another Stephen King book, a much more conventional pick this time, because this is Stephen King's It from 1986. I don't want to spend too much time on this one, because I think it's pretty well-known, and rather in the zeitgeist at the moment with the recent films and things. But it's not necessarily my favorite Stephen King book. Like, I'd even say I personally perhaps prefer Wolves of the Keller. But this is undoubtedly Stephen King at the absolute height of his powers. Like, there are so many moments in this book, especially during the first half, where it's just him flexing. Like, he's just going, I am the greatest writer of all time, and I'm going to write this big ridiculous book, and here it is, bow before me, and he pulls it off. You know, it has a reputation for a good reason. And look, there are problems with it, not least of which is the infamous underage sewer orgy, which, if you don't know what all that's about, look it up. I don't want to bother discussing it here. And again, like Wolves of the Keller, I do see how that fits in with the themes of the story, but I also do think is rather exploitative and gratuitous and probably could be cut and not really lose anything from the book and even strengthen it. But, and maybe this is, you know, part of King's strategy is it's like 1,000 pages long or whatever. So that's like 1% of this book is that scene that I can just sort of ignore and put out of my head. Because the other 99%, or, you know, probably 90, 85% of the book, I think is just absolutely great. It's King absolutely at the top of his game and somehow pulling off this crazy, complex, often ridiculous story. But this is one of those books, one of those things that I think is as good as it is like meant to be, right? Its reputation precedes it and it lives up to it. This is King's defining work. And genuinely, like, I'm sure there are a lot of people who would just go, it's a silly clown story about a monster clown or whatever, and then there's a space turtle and a sewer orgy. But I do think is genuinely one of the like achievements of 20th century literature. Like, it is a definitive statement even of what popular and widely read influential literature is in at least the later half of the 20th century through to now, like with the new movies, with the Stranger Things and all that. Like, it is one of the most influential books that has ever been written, and I think deservedly so. All right, let's keep going with my third favorite book of the year. I had a lot of vampire books in my bottom 10, my least favorite books that I read in 22. But at number 3, we have the best vampire book that I read this year, which is The Tale of the Body Thief from 1992 by Anne Rice. This is, of course, the fourth book in the Vampire Chronicles series, following on from Queen of the Damned, which I presume is where most people stop, whether that's just to coincide with the movies or also because they've got quite long-winded and fairly ridiculous by that point. I mean, there's some cool stuff in Queen of the Damned, but it does go on a bit, and it was where I stopped for a while. I did jump forward and read a couple of the later books for research purposes, but I was a bit put off by the prospect of The Tale of the Body Thief, which, as its title suggests, is about a literal body thief. There is a body swapping, I was going to say demon, but I think he's like just a dude who can inhabit other people's bodies, and the premise is that he tricks Lestat, the cool, Byronic, superpowered vampire rock star from the previous novels, into giving him his body, and then Lestat is made human and he has to try and get his body back. That's the premise, which even by ridiculous gothic vampire story standards is pretty out there, and it sounded a bit silly. Like, I felt like the series may have jumped the shark with this one, so I put it off ages. But I've been going through a bit of a goth phase lately, so I jumped back in, and I'm very glad I did, because I still think, like, clearly Interview with the Vampire is the best book in the series, and I would argue perhaps the best and even arguably the most influential vampire book ever written. So that's clearly the best one in the series, but I think this one might be my favorite. As silly as the premise is, I think it really works. Like, it sounds ridiculous, but it sort of makes sense that Lestat would do this, would be tricked into this deal with the body thief because of how arrogant and untouchable he thinks he is. And it was really interesting and satisfying to see him sort of brought down a peg and humbled a bit in this book, which I think does a really interesting job of exploring some of these ideas about power and humanity that vampires imply. That's drawn out. This is more of a meditation, a character piece. Like, there is a crazy subterfuge action plot going on with the trying to get the body back and things, but it's mostly just about, okay, you've had someone who's so powerful and so, infamous and untouchable and all of this, and he's brought back to Earth. He's reclaimed his humanity, which is the thing he thinks he wants. And seeing him deal with that, and I'm going to spoil it a bit here, but what I think is really interesting is ultimately reject it. Like, all these other books about vampires wanting to become human again, how we've become monsters and things, and you read that and go, like, or at least I do, and again, I'm gothing out at the moment, but, like, I would take the dark gift in an instant. Like, being a vampire would be so much better than being human. And that's sort of what Lestat realizes, like, pretty early on. He's like, oh, wait a second. Don't think I appreciate what I had. Grass is greener and all that. Like, this sucks, and being an all-power vampire is awesome. And how do I get that back? So I was glad to see it take that route rather than just be this whole humans are everything humanist narrative, which, you know, someone like Pratchett probably would have taken. The other thing this book does, though, is it makes Lestat into more of a villain again. Or if not a villain, more of an ambivalent anti-hero. As much as Byronic heroes tend to be romanticized these days and are just purely heroic, the character type in its purest form, like, these are not good people, and that is brought back in. Like, Lestat sucks. He's an awful person, and he's in a position as a vampire to get away with whatever he wants, mostly, and it's interesting to see him lean back into more of that villainous, or at least more of a chaotic neutral role after he sort of got valorized and Mary Sued quite a bit through the previous two books, to the point where he was like the all-powerful king of all vampires, essentially a superhero kind of character by the end of Queen of the Damned. And look, the last book in the series is called, what is it, Prince Lestat or Lestat, Prince of Atlantis or something. So, you know, I guess we're headed back in that direction. But this was a nice little reset that really made me fall back in love with the series, which I'm very keen to continue on with. The next book, actually, Memnock the Devil, on the first ever What You've Been Reading episode that I put out, I think this was the book Alice said they were reading at the time, Melmoth the Wanderer, which is sort of like this wandering Jew narrative from the 19th century. And they said, you know, I think this probably has something to do with vampire fiction and things. And yet, Memnock is, from what I've read of the blurb and things, is apparently a complete rewriting of Melmoth the Wanderer. So yeah, looking forward to getting into that. All right, moving on now to number two. We have another appearance, the final appearance by Jeff Vandermeer with his 2006 book, Shriek and Afterword. Now, we're going to require a bit of setup for this one. So Shriek is the second book in the Ambergris trilogy. This is one with the whale city with the mushroom people. But the first one, the first book, The Tales of Ambergris, is a collection of short stories. This one follows on from two main stories in that. There's one that is called The Transformation of Martin Lake, which is about an art critic who leads a social rebellion. But more importantly, Shriek is sort of a direct sequel to what I think is the best, and I think clearly the standout story from the Tales of Ambergris. I keep calling it The Tales of Ambergris. That's the name of the series. The short story collection is called City of Saints and Madmen. But anyway, from that collection, there is a story called The Early History of Ambergris, which is like this historical, almost academic history of the colonization, or the attempted colonization of this city, and the presumed dispossession of the mushroom people, the Greys, the Grey Caps. But this story is presented as like a survey of all the other historical tellings of this history by a historian named Duncan Shriek, who is, through footnotes, and I think there's like 100 of them for this short story, is commenting on the inconsistencies in the historical reports and sort of pointing out where the narrative is perhaps unreliable and things like that. So a bit of a metafictional thing going on there. So Shriek is an afterword, or as its subtitle suggests, is a sequel to that sort of series, because at the end of that history, or presumably following it, Duncan Shriek goes missing. And then the Shriek novel is narrated by his sister, the art critic Janice Shriek, who provided commentary on the other story, or was a character in that. And this is a book that is presented as, I think it's her autobiography that she has written, or rather than her autobiography, it is a biography of Duncan that she has written, though it's from her perspective, so we get a bit of crossover in the experiences, a little bit like Rob Wilkins' Life with Footnotes biography. But anyway, so it's her version, her published, fictionally published version of her brother's life, trying to unravel the mystery of what happened to him. And all throughout this book, though, there is commentary and interjections from Duncan, who is reading the book. Actually, I don't know if the book goes up to when he goes missing or not, or if that narrative plays out in his commentary. Maybe these were his comments before on the manuscript of the book before he went missing. And then perhaps there is a third layer of her commenting on his comments. I can't remember if that was there or not, or I'm making it up. But either way, we got lots of narratives jumping in and around here. And there's a school of thought that, you know, Vandermeer, who has this tendency for difficult or metafictional narratives, like talking about Dead Astronauts earlier, where it's this kaleidoscopic thing where there's numbers in the margins about which parallel world you're in and things like that, you know. But there, I think he's gone off the deep end. There are people, I've read some reviews complaining that, oh, this is too hard to follow and it's a bit self-indulgent or anything. Obviously, it's my second favorite book of the year, but I think it's brilliant. And I did listen to this as an audiobook, and then again, go back and check out the physical book and see how the notes sort of fit in and things. But maybe it worked better that way, because I can sort of see, if you're looking at the page and you're having to bounce around between all these narratives that are interjected in different fonts and styles and colors and the marginalia and things, that it might be a bit hard to follow. But just getting the story read through, which it's in different voices, so you can tell when different people are talking. But just getting the story unfolding and flow maybe helped me get into it a bit more than if you were trying to decipher it looking at the page. Having said that, I don't think it's that difficult to follow if you just read through it. But yeah, if you're interested in this, maybe the audiobook is the way to do it. But I highly, highly recommend this. I mean, on top of just like, that's all the metafictional and structural things that are going on with it. Again, this is just a really cool story about unreliable historians and underworld conspiracies and mushroom men revolutions in this like diesel punk Lovecraftian whale city and things. So the story itself, I think, is worth reading, but I think it is made even better by this really cool and complex metafictional narrative and style that Vandermeer is applying to it, and which ties into the story itself. Yeah, really, really cool. High recommend on Shriek by Jeff Vandermeer. I think I'm going to say it's my favorite Jeff Vandermeer book. Previously, Obviously, that probably would have been Bourne, or maybe the second Area X novel, Authority. I think most people would choose the first book, Annihilation, and Authority sort of seems the odd one out in that trilogy, but it's my favorite. So I highly recommend that trilogy. I recommend all of Jeff Vandermeer's books, really, even though I do probably prefer Bieville overall. But yeah, I was really pleasantly surprised by Ambergris, because I got back to some of his earlier short stories and his other book, Venice Underground, which I thought was good, but not really on par with his later stuff. And Shriek, yeah, just blew me away. Great book. All right, and finally, at number one, another repeat appearance, this time by Octavia Butler, with the final published Patmos novel, Clay's Ark, from 1984. And I say it's the final published book because in the actual chronology of the narrative, I think it's second last, and then the first published book is actually the furthest set in the future, although Clay's Ark is actually right in the middle if you want to include Survivor, which was the first written book, but the third published book that she then disowned, because it precedes that, but then that book is set on a completely different planet that has nothing really to do with the Patnists and the Clay Ark story. So it's all a bit complex. But you could almost read this book by itself, I think. I think you wouldn't get the most out of it. It'd be lacking the context of everything else that's going on. But whereas the other three Butler-endorsed books of the trilogy, at least, they're telling the story of the Patnists, the psychics. So the Wild Seed and Mind of My Mind are about Doro and the breeding program that brought them into fruition. And then Patnists, the first book, is set far in the future after they've taken power, and it's like a war between the psychics and the Clay Ark. Clay's Ark, as its title suggests, is the Clay Ark side of the story. Now, Clay Ark, who are the Clay Ark? The Clay Ark are the half-human cat people, or the fully inhuman cat people, or the wholly human cat people, depending on your takeaway from the story. That's sort of, you know, what it's dealing with there. The humanoid cat people, who are, you know, perceived as the antagonists in the first Patmos book, Patmaster. They are the invading force that are attacking the Patmos, because they've taken over the land, and they're rapidly eating everything up, right? Anyway, the Clay Ark are called the Clay Ark because Clay's Ark is the name of the first spaceship that got sent into space to another planet from Earth. So the first man voyage to a planet outside the solar system. I think Clay was someone who invented some kind of technology or something. I can't really remember, but it had something to do with the program, so it's named after them. It's Clay's Ark, and then this is a generation ship mission that goes to another planet and comes back. Now, we don't know what happens in that story. That's not what Survivor's about. Survivor is about a different Ark that gets sent off Earth by people who are neither psychic nor cat people, who they're like a refugee ship who leave Earth and then go and land as refugees on another planet following all of this. But of course, that's the first book she wrote, but didn't publish second, and then now disowns and doesn't include anything, but is fourth chronologically. But yeah, the ship comes back to Earth. So it goes to the planet, comes back, Clay's Ark, and it crash lands on Earth. And there is one survivor named Eli, who is infected with this alien, I was going to say virus, but they do a whole discussion. It's more of a symbiote than a virus or a bacteria or whatever, but it behaves like a viral infection, right? This is essentially a pandemic story. But if the pandemic was an alien symbiote that got brought back from outer space that mutates people into cat people, or it doesn't mutate the people, but it transforms them and their children, the cat people. So there's a lot going on there. And this story is about Eli and how he tries to contain the infection, and also about a human family who sort of get caught up in this battle between Eli's commune of the infected Clay Ark and what are called Car families. Who this is sort of, we're in like a post-apocalyptic kind of Mad Max setting as well. We've got to add that in there on top of everything else. But these violent bands of nomadic humans who sort of drive around and, you know, rape and pillage. And then they're sort of having a battle with the Clay Ark that this family get caught up in, and then they take refuge or are forcibly accosted into the Clay Ark community. Again, this is all extremely morally ambiguous. But that's sort of what's going on there, as that's all just the premise of the book. But yeah, we've got a lot of moral ambiguity going on here. And I think Butler does moral ambiguity better than anyone else I've read, certainly in science fiction. Because she's not doing like the over-the-top villainous anti-hero thing that Ambergris is doing with Lestat. And she's not doing the like free speech gone mad, libertarian, I'm a university professor who wants to sleep with my underage students thing that a lot of more revered white male authors in her field do. But she's dealing with some genuinely troubling things. Like, all her books are about genetic breeding and infections and things like that, which are obviously alluding to slavery and animal ethics and things like that. Also, invariably, in all of her series, there is I think most of them, maybe not in Xenogenesis, but in all the others, there is an underage girl who falls in
in love with an older male and is maybe coerced into that relationship, but she actually is okay with it. And Butler has said some very alarming things about it, how it is her dream to breed, to have been immortal and breed people. She's dead now, so that didn't happen. But she's open in saying not only are these ideas of genetic manipulation and eugenics, essentially, alien eugenics, but eugenics, interesting to her, but they are something that she fantasized about doing herself. Not in a real world context, about she wanted to be the immortal guy who raised the superhumans. So all of that is extremely alarming, and perhaps if it came from another type of person in another period, would just be outright rejected, and maybe it still should be. Butler, again, is the first and for a long time only professional black female science fiction writer. So there's quite a different perspective and more complexity going on here. And I think she presents these ideas as genuinely complex and ambiguous. It's not just like, oh, there's one side and there's the other and everyone's crazy or everyone's one side is clearly favored. She is working out conundrums and she's not really presenting answers, but not in a way that isn't satisfying where you get to the end and go, what was all that about? Like, there are points to be made. Anyway, the point I'm getting at there is I think Octavia Butler is great, and that the issues she handles are complex and concerning, but she manages to pull them off. And I don't really know if there are many others who could. I mean, even Samuel R. Delaney, who's the first male black science fiction writer and is also another one of my favorite authors, I think he's really great. But some of his stuff does cross into more of an exploitative or simplified version of transgression, whereas I think Butler always sort of, even if there are some implications about her work, from a literary standpoint, I think she goes a lot deeper than most authors and ends up with a better product as a result. I mean, I've been going on sort of about my reservations, perhaps, about Butler and this book, but clearly it's my favorite book I've read all year. This book's great. I was going to say it's unlike anything else. It's quite like Butler's other books, which, as I said, they're all about genetic alien or mutation and things like that. I mean, she is the author of my favorite vampire book, Kindred, which has a lot of similarities with the Patmist series, but particularly Clay's Ark. That was the final book she ever wrote, and this is one of the first ones, so there's a bit of mirroring there. I still think that's probably my favorite Butler book, and I'd have to say the Xenogenesis trilogy as a whole is certainly her crowning achievement. But I think Clay's Ark is probably my second favorite standalone book of hers. I did really like the second parable book, and the first Xenogenesis book, Dawn, is really great. The problem with Dawn is it doesn't have an ending. Like, it is all set up and it doesn't really pay off without the rest of the trilogy. So as a self-contained standalone novel, I was really shocked by how good Clay's Ark is, because the other Patmist books are good, but they are not amateurish, but less refined compared to Butler's later writing. But Clay's Ark being the final published of the books, I think it shows that Butler's really come into her own by that point. And she then goes on to immediately write the Xenogenesis trilogy and pretty much just knock it out of the park from there on to become, one of the best and most important authors in the history of science fiction. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I'm already seeing a lot more sort of critical attention and acclaim being focused on her, so I expect she's going to become a more popular figure with the TV adaptation of Kindred and everything. But she was already one of my favorite authors, and then I read this series and now it cemented it, but also even bolstered her in my esteem. Like, Octavia Butler is a pretty incredible person. And if you read here, I'll do another recommendation. If you are interested in Butler, it's not a biography, but a sort of critical evaluation of her work. If you're interested in this from an academic perspective, this being ostensibly an academic podcast, but more of an academic examination, but still biological, that's a bit of a slip there, a biographical structure, narrative to it. Jerry Canavan, who is a friend of mine, but is also an extremely influential and well-respected contemporary science fiction critic from the US. He put out a book a few years ago, 2017, I think it was. I think it's just called Octavia E. Butler by Jerry Canavan. That's Jerry with a G. Canavan, C-A-N-N-A-V-A-N, I think. This book's really cool. If you're interested in Octavia Butler or you're already familiar with her and want to go sort of in deep and get a bit more information out of her, I found that book really, really interesting just to read. Like, really useful for my own research and things, but also just really interesting as a narrative. Because he went through all her papers, and he talks all about her books that she was going to write and these unpublished stories and stuff. So it's, really, really interesting, and I think quite digestible as well. So a bit of a bonus recommend on perhaps the best nonfiction book that I've read this year, maybe. All right, I'll shut up now. I'll leave it there, lest I start rambling again. And yeah, maybe I'll do this again next year. We'll see. It is, as I'm recording this, it's now the second day of 2023. And so far, well, I've finished reading two books. One is Adulthood Rights, the second book in Butler's Xenogenesis trilogy, which was much better than I remembered it being. So that was very good. And the other book I finished reading in preparation for the next podcast is I reread Thief of Time and can confirm that it's still fucking great. So I'll be back with an episode about that when I can. This is on the Patreon feed only, so I don't need to carry on anymore. I'll let you get on with your day and your new year. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Oh, and that's what we've been reading.